Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
A truly magnificent thing about the way the brain was coded, Sam thought, was that it could say excuse me while meaning screw you. Unless they were unreliable or clearly established as lunatics or scoundrels, characters in novels, movies, and games were meant to be taken at face value, the totality of what they did or what they said. But people, the ordinary, the decent, and basically honest, couldn't get through the day without that one indispensable bit of programming that allowed you to say one thing and mean, feel, even do another.
That's Gabrielle Zevin reading an excerpt from her best-selling, critically acclaimed novel, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. The best-selling author, John Green, says Gabrielle's novel is one of the best books he's ever read. And I have to agree with him. Gabrielle has written a fascinating novel about two friends who decide to collaborate on designing video games. These games are so imaginative and innovative that you'd wish you could play them in real life. I sure wish I could, and maybe someday they will become real games. Fingers crossed. But Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow is not just about video games. Gabrielle also explores identity, disability, failure, and our need to connect with our fellow humans. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles to talk about her book.
It never occurred to me to write about video games before. Gaming, for me, had been some of my seminal storytelling experiences, and they had really kind of determined even parts of the ways I wrote novels, and yet I had never addressed it. And I think this is not actually an experience unique to me because, you know, I was born in 1977, which puts me squarely in the Oregon Trail generation, the generation that is either like a young Gen Xer or an old millennial and kind of determined by the fact that you may have played Oregon Trail in a computer lab in a school somewhere. And so like the first generation of people to have played video games as children are now turning into their 40s and even their 50s. And I thought this was worth thinking about. How would your life have been changed if you had consumed video games for your whole life? How does that change your experience of even, you know, mortality, relationships, and everything else?
Mm-hmm. And you really thought it through very well, and that's what makes your novel so powerful. One of the most fascinating things about your novel is that although it is mainly about video games, you're able to include a lot of other interesting themes. How did you manage that?
A great subject for a book is like a great big bowl, and it attracts many other subjects to it, and it fits many things inside of it. And I knew when I started conceiving of the novel that video games were a great subject because the whole world was contained within discussing video games. So I believe that you can write about anything and find a shadow history of, say, what it is to be a person or, you know, an artist in a certain period of year. So I could tell you about like the history of bread making or the history of furniture making or the history of anything, and you would learn something about what it was like to be a person by experiencing that time through the lens of whatever thing you're talking about. And so I think that's really what drew me to video games as subject.
Did you know that before you started writing Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow that there were all these other subjects that kind of fit into this amazing bowl of video games, or did you kind of discover that as you were writing the book?
You know, I think the hard thing as a novelist is not having ideas. It's choosing which ones are worth following. But with this book, I didn't know. I never know. You know, and I think that's part of the joy of writing a novel. You take this leap into this abyss when you kind of really give yourself over to a new creative thing. The deeper I got with it, the more I started to see that I could see almost everything about, again, the last 30 years of life within this subject. You know, my life overlaps with the length of this book. You know, it was really a way for me to talk about time and my experience on the planet.
Yeah. Let's talk about the two main characters, Sam Mazur and Sadie Green. Can you tell us a bit about them?
I can. Sam Mazur, he is a kid who has had a horrible accident when he was very young, and the fallout from that accident, I think, determines a lot about why he plays video games and a lot about his sort of even the way he relates to people. A thing that I share with Sam is that we're both half Jewish and half Korean, and it's the first time I'd ever given somebody my ethnic identity. And so a lot of Sam's experiences around race, though not all of his thoughts about it, but some of his experiences are mine. This feeling of, you know, I was raised in a town that was like 66% Jewish, and so there were ways in which I always felt myself to be more that way and didn't understand the ways in which I was other than that. And then when I sort of all of a sudden traveled to Asia in my 20s, I became aware that I might have been an entirely different person if I had been, you know, born somewhere else, and I might have like felt more Asian in a sense, you know. And so these are some things that Sam experiences. Sadie Green, she is a video game designer like Sam, and I think a core thing that happens to her is that her sister has cancer and manages to survive when she's a kid, but I think it always makes her think about mortality a lot, and that's one of the reasons she is drawn to video games. A lot of Sadie's experiences as a person in a male-dominated profession, I think probably come from some of my own experiences as a novelist for the last 17 years, and so that's a lot of the Sadie Green character.
Yeah. How does Sam's disability affect his friendship with Sadie?
I mean, I think it affects everything for Sam. I think he, because of, you know, the injury he sustained when he was a kid, he doesn't like being in his body. And so something that video games can do for him is allow him to not be in his body. But I think in a sense, you know, it certainly cuts off for him the idea of a physical relationship with Sadie. It's just not something that he can do, you know, at least for most of the book. It's not something he can even contemplate. It makes him a person who is definitely more in his head than in his body.
Mm, yeah. The first video game that Sam and Sadie create together is called Ichigo, A Child of the Sea. Can you describe it for us?
Ichigo is about a child who is caught in a tsunami, and he ends up basically like far away from home, but he doesn't have language really, and he doesn't know even his first name, and he can't really count to numbers past 10, and all he has is a football jersey on in the back that says 1-5, which is Ichi and Go, or Jugo, which is 15 in Japanese. And so the story is how a kid manages to like get home lacking language, really, is what the story of Ichigo is.
Mm-hmm. And an interesting thing is that Sadie and Sam originally envisioned the character as non-gender, neither a he nor a she, correct?
Yes. I think Ichigo is a they because they don't want the child to be either a girl or a boy. Because at that age, and in visually even, if you think about what, say, graphics at that time look like, you really couldn't see. And if anything, it's a compromise for them because it is both of their work together. And I think it's one of the ways in which Sam kind of subtly overtakes Sadie when they make the Ichigo character ultimately becomes a boy in terms of it being easier to market, which ends up being true, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. One of the most fascinating things about Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow is the incredible amount of work that goes into creating a video game. How did you acquire all of this information?
Well, the best thing that happened for me was that I had a book before this one that sold a lot of copies, which meant I had a lot more time to just do hard research into the topic. So there's 5 years between my last book and this book, and a lot of that time was spent really just learning everything I could about video game design. And as I mentioned to you before, there were ways in which I just, the farther I got, and even knowing some video game designers now a little bit, I realized that essentially we do a very similar job, minus how much burdensome tech they have. We're storytellers. And even to push it farther than that, maybe to a ridiculous extent, you know, programming is really just a series of languages. And these languages are trying to communicate in a video game designer's case, some kind of experience. And really, I'm doing the exact same thing as a novelist. And so at a certain point, I realized that the technical things were not as interesting as the human things, and just the ways in which all artists work and the things in their lives become the stories that they tell.
Mm, yeah, very well said. You explore the idea of failure, and this is a theme that I'm always thinking about. And Sadie contemplates it after one of their later games isn't well received. What is it about this theme that resonates with you?
I failed a lot. You know, that's the thing. No, you know, it's funny. Like, when I told my agent about the book, I said, hey, it's about love, art, video games, and time, and failure. And my agent was kind of like, I like the love, art, video games, and time part. But I think, in a way, for anybody who's in the arts, failure is an inevitable part of the process. And at first, when it happened to me, you know, I'm an overachiever. I went to Harvard. But at first, when I failed professionally, it felt terrible. You know, I was like, I felt, as Sadie describes, like covered with a fine coating of ash. You think you'll never get past it. You think everybody knows. You think the guy at the like grocery store is looking at you like, that girl's novel did not sell well. And in that same year, I had another novel because I wrote a book for children, a book for adults that year, and the adult novel failed and the children's book did really well. And I had another novel that succeeded, and that provided its own set of garbage. And so it's funny, I just realized that there was a lot to be learned from success and from failure. And in fact, sometimes failure is much more interesting. What I have found is that the place of redemption isn't in sort of the external reaction to a thing, it's in the work itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it reminds me of a phrase that pops up early in your book, the famous Samuel Beckett quote, fail again, fail better. You've said that tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow reflects your belief that a great love story can also be a great friendship story. How does your belief, this belief connect with the relationship between Sam and Sadie?
You know, it's funny. I think that's a line that I said to make it simple for people to understand what the book is. But it really is, it's a friendship story, but it's also a work story. And so to me, it's a story about colleagues as much as friendship. Their friendship is interesting, and I think that's more relatable, I think, to many people. But where their truly great love story is in the work that they make. And I think some people, and Sam and Sadie are these people, they don't end up with all of the things that I think we conventionally consider to be happy endings in stories. So I'm sort of thinking about the house and the children and the walk down the aisle. Like, they don't have those things. And so we don't think their relationship is romantic. And yet there's a great sense of romance between them. Their romance is in the work, and the children they make is the work. And it's funny, like, in terms of their friendship, sometimes they are not good friends to each other. You know, I think they're sort of bad at being friends, even though their intimacy, and nobody will ever know you as well as those two people know each other, and that's something they grapple with. But I think this story is about really childhood friends, that kind of like hothouse atmosphere of the intimacy you have and that you can only have when you're age 13 and have like hundreds of hours to spend together.
Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that these beautiful video games that you helped Sam and Sadie create could become a reality?
I think there's some chance of it, but video game development is slow. Novel writing is fast. And so I had no burden to actually worry about whether these would actually be hits, be fun, be technically possible. And especially because a lot of the video games that I describe, I tied them to particular technologies that would make them make sense for that time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if like we'll ever see them. Obviously, my publisher Knopf made Emily Blaster, which can be played on my website, which is Sadie's game that she makes in a college class. It's the easiest game in the book that involves shooting the poetry of Emily Dickinson. So that's the one game. But I would love to
see
that.
Yeah, I played that. Yeah, that was so much fun playing that. I really had fun.
It needs more levels.
It needs more levels, and we need the other games as well. Temple Hill Entertainment and Paramount Pictures have bought the rights to your novel, and you're currently working on the screenplay adaptation. What can you tell us about it?
It's difficult. You know, because it's a long book. It's like 500 pages, and it's not so much. I'm willing to, go in and like mess around and like tear things apart. But the greatest difficulty is how much fealty and affection my producers have for every element and moment of the book. You know, people talk about Hollywood people not reading, but not Temple Hill. Temple Hill, those people have read this book so many times. And so anytime I kind of make like a change that like, you know, is different, it's disgust, let's put it that way. But I think it was not an easy nut to crack, the screenplay. I think we almost have gotten to something pretty good. And there's still part of me that worries like that you'll end up like missing so many things from the book in a movie, you know. But I think I'm hoping that we get to a place that really captures the experience of this core relationship of these two people that are better at work than they are at life.
Mm-hmm. Gabrielle Zevin, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. I'm looking forward to the film, and I hope that sometime soon we will be able to play Ichigo, A Child of the Sea, and the sequel, Ichigo 2, Go Ichigo, Go!
Thank you so much.
Gabrielle Zevin is the author of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Find out more about Gabrielle and her book at wpr.org/beta.
There were a couple crucial mistakes. The first was that neither agency ever bothered trying to learn specifically what the Branch Davidians believe.
Coming up, Jeff Gwynn joins us to talk about his compelling book, Waco, David Koresh, The Branch Davidians, and A Legacy of Rage. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.